Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today is an environmental historian whose books explore our human relationship with nature, food, and the environment through history. Anne Velises wrote Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. She now has a new book written. She has written the biography of an iconic marine snail, mistakenly regarded as an inexhaustible seafood. Anne Velises' latest book is Abalone, The Remarkable History and Uncertain Future of California's Iconic Shellfish. Anne Velises, welcome.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Well, before we talk about your most recent book, I'd like to ask you about your previous book, Kitchen Literacy. And I understand you worked on this book for 10 years.
I did. It takes me a long time to write books. I'm, as you mentioned, I'm an environmental historian, and I'm the kind of writer that asks a question and seeks the answer. I think some writers write books because they have an argument they want to make. I usually start with a question that I'm really fascinated by. And with Kitchen Literacy, and it's kind of interesting to think about because I was writing it in the 90s, I just started to realize that I knew so little about where my food came from. I mean, it's kind of a thing now. A lot of people think about where does our food come from. But at that time, it wasn't such a big deal. And somehow it struck me that I know so little about where all the foods in the supermarket came from. You know, they each had a story and I just was clueless about them. So as a historian, I was fascinated to start thinking about how was it that we got into the situation, you know, where we knew so little about where our foods came from, and we thought that was entirely normal. And so I went back through time and kept a bead on specifically that question of what did people know about their foods through time, and how did that change? And it was a fascinating journey to research that book. And so anyway, that's why it took so long. I had to go and writing a history book in some ways, I think, is like making a quilt. You have to think about all the pieces of the story and you have to find pieces and start weaving them together. So I, in that book, I was able to track down some interesting old diaries of women who were cooking and what they wrote about foods in their gardens. And then through the industrialization of our food system at the late 19th century, when we had so many people moving into cities and really enormous transformation of the food system, I was able to look at historic cookbooks and historic advertising to try to figure out how it was that people's knowledge, what they knew about their foods, what they thought about their foods changed. So it was a really fascinating project.
Well, this book on kitchen literacy, you pose the question, you suggest you ask children where food comes from, and they'll probably say the supermarket. But then when you ask adults, they don't know much more. And I've been shocked sometimes. I try to not convey that shock at adults. And these are not dummy. These aren't dumb people. I have a friend who's a Harvard graduate, and I'm often surprised at how he doesn't know the answer to that question often about food.
Right. And maybe he doesn't even care to think about it. I mean, it's just so normalized that we are used to going to the supermarket, grabbing something and thinking about the story, you know, of the advertisement, you know, what the, in my book, I talk about, you know, growing up eating cereals, you know, that had like Tony the Tiger or the Fruit Loops toucan on them, and somehow buying or believing those stories are the foods, are the stories attached to foods without really thinking critically about it. And one of the things that was really fun during that book is as I was writing it, you know, the movement to be interested in local foods really came into being in a much bigger way. And I'm sure since you're interested in this topic, Nancy, you know too that learning about the stories of our foods can be so rewarding and fun, you know, especially if you have local farms or farmers markets. It's really a neat opportunity to learn more.
And before I knew about your book, Kitchen Literacy, I read Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Oh, yes.
Precisely what he does. He sets out to discover where the foods are raised and what happens to them between the farm and the supermarket shelf. And it wasn't always easy. They don't always want you to know.
Right. One of the things I think that was interesting from a historical perspective, and I mean, we know it, I think, by intuition, is that we love foods that have good stories. And so back when kitchens and farms or gardens were closer and we knew more about where our vegetables came from, where the animals that we eat as meat came from, you know, if we knew that they came from the farm down the road or from out back or whatever, we had a good story. But when foods became industrialized, the stories were less good, you know, animals pumped with antibiotics and packed into cages tight, or vegetables that travel 1,000 miles. And so really one of the ways that the food industry helped us to accept the change was to attach new stories to foods. And so that's where, you know, we start, we had to learn to value things like hygiene and convenience. And one of the things that was fascinating in that book was to learn that people really resisted that change at first. They didn't like it. And we had to learn to value food in new ways. Calorie counts. I mean, all these things that we think of as important today are things we've learned and been taught to think of as important, in part through advertising.
In fact, the producers know that we like these old stories of life on the farm. And so the package you buy may have a farm with a cow and it looks so idyllic, when the reality is it's industrial food.
Yeah.
And yet they don't portray it that way on their packaging.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an art form and a profession to figure out what people like and to, you know, deliver that story, to attach it to whatever the product is, of course. And so, you know, studying that through time, I think was really revealing to me and helped me to just think more critically, of course, about those things as I am a consumer of food and a shopper today. And it was my hope that in writing the book and telling it as a story of how this happened through time would help other people to think more about that as well.
My guest is Anne Velises, and she writes about the human relationship with nature and food. And a previous book was about that, where our food comes from. The title was Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. I certainly believe we need to get it back, but how do we go about doing that, Anne?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think people need to understand that it's important. And then I think there's just so many more opportunities to do that now. One of the things that people can do is to, you know, shop more at farmers markets and seek out other kinds of local food sources. There's a wonderful thing called community supported agriculture that that many people are trying and experimenting with today, where you can actually get connected to a farm and subscribe to get a box of food every week. Where I live up on the Oregon coast, we have a similar thing with seafood, a CSA for seafood, where you can connect with a commercial fisherman and get pay early in the year and then get a subscription for fresh ocean fish throughout the year. So there's different ways that people are experimenting and doing better. Of course, that is only a small part of the whole larger food system. But I think as more consumers put a value and are willing to pay for foods that are local, that have fewer pesticides and such, I think it helps to put pressure on the larger food system as well. So that's one way to do it. Of course, people are working on policies to help that as well. And that's another realm. But in my book, I was kind of focused on, what consumers can do. And once you start getting into it, as I was saying, I think it's sort of really interesting and wonderful because you get more excited about finding fresh local foods, and they're delicious and beautiful, and you're more inspired to cook. And that's a healthy thing, to cook meals with fresh foods. So anyway, I think that's the way we start, at least.
Well, we're fortunate here in Chico to support farmers markets. I've noticed over the past 30 years how they've expanded and grown the size of the markets, the number of vendors, and the number of days you've got a farmers market. And I think we're especially fortunate here. And I think about, say, youngsters growing up in the inner city, they don't have a farmers market.
Yeah. And sometimes they don't even have a supermarket. You know, there are so many food deserts. Yes. And it's just, I mean, it's yet another thing that, you know, in this day and age, we're talking about social justice and inequity in society in so many ways. And the food system is yet another way, which is in which this is prevalent. I think there's been some good initiatives looking toward how do we rectify that? You know, how do we bring community gardens into inner cities or school gardens into places where there are not, where there isn't food? And there's some great examples of that in different cities around the country. But of course, they're small, kind of, you know, startup kinds of things. But they're great examples, and we could do better with that, certainly.
Well, before we leave this topic, I'll just remind people the title of this book that you've written is Kitchen Literacy: How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. So now, going back to Ann the Historian, you start your next book, your most recent book, which is Abalone: The Remarkable History and Uncertain Future of California's Iconic Shellfish. And you go way, way back in history, Anne, to start this story of the abalone. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Anne Velisis, author of Abalone. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, environmental historian Anne Velisis. When you started writing this book, how did you get interested in abalone? I mean, I can see food, kitchen literacy, because we all eat food, but how did you get interested in abalone?
Well, literally, I feel like it was inspiration. I was taking a walk in Central California, on the coast in Big Sur, and I came across an abalone shell. And for listeners who don't know, abalone shells are these brilliant, beautiful, iridescent shells. And I was just struck by its beauty. And I just started to wonder, what is the animal that made this shell? And it didn't take me long to realize that the animal, abalone, not only has this shell, but had a big foot that became a meat that people coveted and loved so much. And so this animal had a really rich cultural and culinary history as well. And one of the pieces of kitchen literacy that I found particularly interesting, I wrote a little section about wild foods, the animals that we eat that are wild, and realized that they're especially vulnerable. You'd kind of think that, boy, we love to eat them. We will manage them carefully and make sure that they persist. But in fact, because we love to eat them so much, our desires to eat them sometimes overshadow our will to conserve them. So anyway, I realized that abalone had a fascinating cultural history. When I started to scratch the surface and look around and talk to people about abalone, I encountered a lot of nostalgia. So many people, especially of a certain age, had memories of when abalone were actually abundant up and down the coast, and when people could just go out and hunt them and gather them, eat them at barbecues on the beach, or some people ate them in sandwiches they brought to school. They were just really common. It was a big part of California coast culture for a while. But then I realized that two species of California abalone now are on the endangered species list, and that many others are imperiled, their species of concern. When I started to realize that, I realized that this was not only a tale, a culinary tale, a food tale, but one that was ecological. And I'm really fascinated in that intersection of what we know about our foods, but don't know about nature and ecology that is fundamental to giving us a robust and healthy food supply. So it was just a natural topic for me to dive into. And it's been an amazing journey to learn so much about these animals and the passion that people have for them. You know, I mentioned that I started to encounter nostalgia for these animals. But when I started to ask people about abalone, I mean, people would describe to me these literally peak experiences of their lives going out into the ocean and diving for abalone. Young people that learned to hold their breath for 3 minutes so they could go underwater deep and search out these animals that have to be popped from reefs in deeper water and come back with a big chunk of meat. There's something, you know, primal and deeply meaningful about it. So anyway, it was fascinating to know about that and to realize that this is an experience that now actually just in during the time that I've written my book that has become not, it's no longer existent. So it's really, it's a striking thing.
Well, now, and you mentioned rather in passing, as if we listeners know, you mentioned a species of abalone, implying that there is more than one. And I guess maybe people assume, well, an abalone is an abalone. But you make that clear. Even on the very cover of your book, you have six different colors of abalone.
Yeah, we have actually, abalone is actually a genus. And so it's kind of a family of creatures. And on the West Coast, we have seven species of abalone. And they're called, many of them are called by different colors having to do with the color of either the shell or the flesh, the tentacles. It's called the epipodial fringe of the abalone, which is used by the animal to reach out and grab seafood. Let me actually just tell you a little bit about the animal. It's an animal that is so valued for its cultural values for the shell and the meat. But it's interesting to know that the animal is this giant snail. It attaches to reefs underwater with its big foot, and it eats what's called drift kelp. So it's sort of the crumbs of the kelp forest, the little pieces of kelp that would get knocked off during a storm or in the waves. And so it has this very interesting little niche. It just sits there and waits till the kelp comes along, and it senses with that fringe I described, it's kind of tentacly fringe, that there's a piece of kelp close, it pulls it under, and it can eat it. And so that's the way it kind of fits into the ecology of the kelp forest. It transforms that amazing solar energy of kelp into this rich piece of into its foot, which is becomes a rich piece of meat. Anyway, yeah, we've got seven species on the West Coast. And one of the parts of the story that I tell is that people did think an abalone is an abalone when they first, when we kind of first started encountering these animals. But through time, we came to realize that, in fact, each one has its own niche and its own story and is different. So that's part of the story.
My guest is Anne Velisis, and her latest book is Abalone: The Remarkable History and Uncertain Future of California's Iconic Shellfish. And I mentioned that you go pretty far back in history, but a part of this is how the Native Americans viewed the abalone And you said this iridescent shell abalone offered hundreds of generations of Native Californians nutrition, tools, beauty, kinship, prestige, creativity, strength, succor, ceremony, and a connection to supernatural realms, all while managing to persist in nearshore coastal waters. And so they had such a close relationship between themselves, the people, and the abalone. But then along came the European colonizers.
Yeah, and that was writing about that phase of California history, which is really like thousands of years, 12 to 13,000 of years of history, was eye-opening and fascinating to me, really. I mean, I could have written a whole book about just that, I hope that an indigenous Californian writer can help write that at some point, or will write that at some point. But what I was just so moved and inspired to think about that. I mean, one of the earliest, a red abalone shell found in the Channel Islands of California, is evidence for one of the earliest meals eaten in the late Pleistocene, evidence for some of the earliest habitation on the West Coast. So eating abalone is something that goes, that's very deeply a Californian thing. And, aside from subsistence, eating the meat, as you mentioned, indigenous Californians used the shell in so many ways. Starting about 6,000 years ago, they were using it for tools. And as they became more skilled in carving the shell, they also started to use it for ornament and decoration, and had all sorts of different kinds of ceremonial and spiritual uses for it as well, some of which persist to this day. One of the neat things I got to do in the book was I went to see some demonstration dances at an intertribal gathering, and that's held each year in Eureka, where dancers from the North Coast tribes get together and share with the public some of their traditional dances that they do at world renewal ceremonies each year with regalia that's made of abalone shell. And it's just extraordinary to think about the tradition of abalone regalia used in dances stretching back for thousands of years. It's very powerful.
Well, there was one connection that I had never made, hadn't thought about, but this sentence in your book, the West Coast fur trade began with the compelling glimmer of abalone. And so you say that these sea otter pelts were, the Europeans wanted the pelts, but they, it wasn't gold or anything else that they would barter for these pelts. It was abalone that the natives wanted up at Vancouver Island.
Yes. And if you remember, the fur trade kind of started in Alaska in the North Pacific, mm-hmm. and kind of came down the West Coast. And early on, when Spanish mariners came to California, they picked up abalone shells. And I think this is sort of one of the fascinating parts of that early history, is these shells are so beautiful. They just would draw anybody's attention. And so you can imagine mariners picking up these shells, these large shells. The abalone shells in California are the largest ones in the world, and taking them with them. They want to take them home as a souvenir. Well, when they were going up the North Coast to obtain pelts from the native people in Southern Alaska, or for hunting themselves, they went and they tried to, trade with other usual trade items, knives or metal or trinkets. But what the native people there wanted were these beautiful big red abalone shells from California. So it started that they would go to Monterey and gather up a bunch of shells and bring them up the coast. And so that was really, yes, the start of the fur trade was very much tied to abalone shells. And what's really ironic or fascinating about that is when the fur trade progressed, of course, people eventually decimated the sea otters. and in fact almost annihilated them completely on the West Coast. And it turns out sea otters are top predators of abalone. So with the sea otters gone, abalone that probably lived mostly in cracks and crevices in most of the coast began to flourish in numbers, you know, unprecedented numbers, kind of in a super, they became super abundant. And so then when subsequent generations of newcomers, the colonizers from Europe, showed up in California, they came to think of abalone abundance as just the natural state of affairs. It was just considered, in fact, kind of a sign of California's natural abundance that there were so many of these shellfish everywhere. And so we, when white people came, that was, they saw abalone in the intertidal zone and in the shallow areas everywhere. So it was just, it's kind of an interesting thing because we, or our ancestors that came later, as they said, yeah, saw them as natural. But it was really, in fact, kind of a sign of an earlier ecological disruption. And we didn't understand that for over 100 years, actually. So it's kind of like our understanding of this animal was based initially on a misperception of reality. And that's one of the really fascinating parts of the story of abalone.
Well, you quote the fact that 50,000 otter pelts were traded in just 50 years. That's an astounding number of otter pelts. No wonder that occurred, what you were just describing. And then the word abalone wasn't even in our vocabulary until 1850. You say there was a Monterey news reporter who was the first one to publish Auloon, this word.
Auloon, yes. And that was an interesting story, how I kind of came to learn the word Auloon. I was talking to a woman, an indigenous woman, Linda Yamani, who's a basket maker, and she's of Rumson descent. And she told me how that word was the native word, Auloon, in the area that was used for abalone. And that word kind of became transmogrified with Spanish into abalone and then abalone. In the 1850s and 60s. Before that, abalone shells were kind of called ear shells because, interestingly enough, there's about 57 species of abalone around the world. In Europe, where Linnaeus was first organizing taxonomy of shells, the abalone are very small. They're about the size of an ear. And so they were called ear shells everywhere. But anyway, I think it's fascinating that Auloon became abalone, and so the word abalone really has an indigenous origin to it.
Well, then, you also mentioned that when you're walking along and you're captivated by the shimmer of abalone shell, and there was a Scottish physicist that you tell about in your book that researched pearl oyster shell, and he made some interesting discoveries. This was David Brewster.
Yeah, I was fascinated to think about, I wanted to understand the iridescence just because it was such an important or, you know, quintessential part of abalone. So I was, I kind of tracked down, well, how did people figure out and how does this iridescence work? And it turns out that it's actually a structural color, not a pigment, you know, like green or red, or a dye. And what that means is the shell of the abalone is made up of very tiny tiles of calcium aragonite, which is a form of calcium carbonate. And if you were to look at it with a microscope, you'd see tiny grooves. And that's this fellow, William Brewster. He was actually a scientist in the 1800s that first looked into iridescence. And I thought it was really fascinating. It turns out he's the same guy who invented kaleidoscopes. So there's something, you know, kind of resonant about kaleidoscopes and iridescence. He figured out that it was these surface gratings, little ridges that the light hits that make the light diffract and behave in unusual ways. And then he also figured out that there were layers, these little layers of tiles that the light went through and diffracted against the surfaces of those tiles as well. So there's just this play of light that makes iridescence happen, and it's on this microscopic scale. And then I followed along to find a more modern researcher looking into abalone shell iridescence, and I found a researcher in Southern California who actually was not working so much on iridescence, but on the strength of abalone shells, because it, in fact, it turns out that iridescence is not, we don't have it because it's shimmering. I mean, abalone don't make shimmering shells because they shimmer. It turns out that the iridescence is kind of a side effect of the need for this animal to have a very strong shell to protect it. And it turns out that lattice of calcium aragonite is very strong. Anyway, I met a really fascinating guy in Southern California, Dr. Mark Myers at the University of San Diego, who showed me scanning electron microscopic images of the shell. And you could really see those tiles, those tiny tiles, 150 of them on the tip of a human hair, are so deeply ordered. I mean, they're like a little brickwork, a latticework that makes, you know, this wildly iridescent and shimmering color that we see in abalone shells. It's really kind of extraordinary.
And you're just mentioning how strong that shell is. And you say in your book that the abalone shell is one of the strongest natural materials on the planet. Who would have guessed that?
I know.
My guest is Anne Velises, and we're talking about her book, Abalone. And you go back through the history, and there comes a time when people are diving for abalone, and they initially just have heavy hard hat suits. These early commercial divers did. And you tell the story of a guy named Charlie Pierce. And
yeah.
What happened to Charlie?
Well, Charlie, it's interesting. I'll just say briefly, commercial diving or commercial gathering of abalone started in the middle of the 18th century, first with Chinese immigrants who were commercial divers who were gathering them, then Japanese divers came and really pioneered the use of these diving suits. They were building on a much longer heritage they had of diving in Japan, not using the suits, but the suits came into use in the late 19th century for underwater construction. And so as these big diving suits kind of became more available, the Japanese divers started to use them. Charlie Pierce was a fellow down in the central part of California. He came from a family of miners, and it was during the Depression, and he was looking for work and went out to the coast around Morro Bay and the central coast, and he saw the Japanese divers using these dive suits, and he decided it would be a great thing for him to try. So he managed to get a hold of one of the construction suits and went out into the deep water. And what he found was just like a motherload of abalone, because abalone at that point closer to shore had been gathered. And so there weren't quite so many, but when you went out into deeper water, they were everywhere growing. And so he was able to start gathering them up. He had a number of brothers. And so he got a boat with the dive suits. They started out having air compression systems where somebody had to pump the air down, and then soon they were able to get gas-operated air compressors to pump air down so somebody could stay underwater for a long time and gather up abalone. So when they first started and kind of figured out how to master the gear and the air system, they were able to bring in hundreds of dozens of abalone per day. It was kind of a heyday of diving for abalone that Charlie Pierce and his family were able to kind of bring in, and they really built up the commercial abalone business in the Central Coast and ended up also developing, you know, processing houses and really built up the supply of abalone. But ultimately, it turns out abalone diving is really dangerous because you're underwater and you go deeper and deeper, especially as the animals in the near shore areas are taken. And And at the time, divers didn't really know about the dangers of going deep, one of which is called decompression sickness, or the bends, which is when you come up too fast. You get bubbles in your blood, basically, that can be very dangerous. And they were very vulnerable to getting their lines cut off and such. And that's actually what happened to Charlie Pearson. As I said, he was a pioneer in the industry. He got his air supply line wrapped up in the propeller of his boat, and the people he was working with couldn't free him soon enough. So that's the people who did that work, or it was very dangerous. So that's what happened to him.
Well, there was another of these divers whose story I found so interesting. This was a Japanese American whose name was Roy Hattori. And his story is so interesting that tell us how an abalone saved Roy Hattori's life.
Well, Roy was a Japanese American diver, and he learned from the old time divers that he grew up with how to go out and dive. And one time he was out in one of the big suit, and he actually got thrown up against a rock, and the helmet of that big suit cracked open, and he felt water, ice cold water, begin to pour into the suit. And he remembered that some of those old time divers had said to him, if you get into that bind, take an abalone and hold it over the hole. And one of the things that's remarkable about abalone, as I mentioned, is this big foot that they use to suction cup themselves onto the rocks. And so instantly the abalone grabbed onto his helmet, suctioned down tight, and filled up that hole. And so the abalone saved his life. And I was really fortunate because I got a chance to hear Roy speak. He was in his 90s when I was, you know, starting to work on my book. Unfortunately, he's passed away now. But he told that story with such affection for abalone, about the story about the abalone saving his life. Anyway, it was fun. It was a great thing to hear directly from him.
And you mentioned he lived to quite an advanced age. And he was here in California during World War II.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I describe in my book is just the horrific racism that those early Chinese immigrant fishermen and then the Japanese fishermen that followed them faced in their work. Just, you know, we're talking a lot about social justice in our country right now. If you go back 100 years, the level of ambient racism was just so incredible. I mean, it's shocking when you go back and are doing historical research to see that. But what happened to Roy and his family was that, you know, after Pearl Harbor hit, of course, Japanese Americans were basically rounded up and shipped off to internment camps. And so Roy had his own boat. He had his business. He was a successful abalone diver, and he had to sell his boat and leave and go to an internment camp. So it was a very demoralizing and awful experience for him that really, you know, made him bitter for many years. But he worked for, he ended up going on to help the war effort, translating, and, you know, he endured and came back to Monterey and continued to raise his family after the war, and had a long, successful life. But it really is, you know, an awful chapter in our history, and it's very important to remember that. One thing that's kind of interesting about it, though, I'll say, is that sometimes awful things that happen to people, like wars, turn out to be good for marine life because people stop fishing. And so there's a number of incidents, times in my book where I'm talking about abalone, and one of them is World War II. When people stopped fishing, it enabled the animals to rebound and be more plentiful. And I think that's a really interesting part of the story as well, that sometimes these animals that we use as wild foods need a break. And we have in our history examples that show that they can rebound when we give them a break.
My guest is Ann Velises, author of a book which chronicles the history and uncertain future of California's shellfish, the abalone. We'll be back after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Anne Velises, author of Abalone, The Remarkable History and Uncertain Future of California's Iconic Shellfish. And we were talking about the hard hat suits that people dived in, but then along comes an innovation. And tell us who the bottom scratchers were, Anne.
Yeah, well, also in the Depression, there came a new sport started to emerge, which was basically called skin diving. And it started, I tell the story of the bottom scratchers, a group of young men who during the Depression went out, and one fellow was out actually harvesting seaweed. Gelidium was starting to be used for different industrial purposes. And he realized that out in the deep water, there were lots of abalone and seafoods to be had. And so he was kind of a tinkerer kind of guy. And so he went back to his shop and he figured out how he could make himself goggles and go out with a spear. And he realized that he could be fishing for seafood. And this was the time of the Depression and, you know, people needed food and were economizing. And so he and his buddies realized they could do this. And more, they went out farther and developed technologies like, as I said, the diving goggles. They actually called it goggle diving for a while, and then fins that they could use to swim. And they ended up really starting a whole new sport of skin diving in Southern California, which became incredibly popular. And shortly thereafter, after World War II, there was developed something called the Aqualung, which we call scuba diving tanks that people could put on and use air supply, not as I described with the hard hat dive suits where you had a compressor on surface, but where you were bringing tanks with you. And people more and more could go out with masks and tanks and explore the undersea environment, but also really be hunting for fish and for abalone. And so these were sports that became incredibly popular, especially after World War II in Southern and Central California. People just so enjoyed going out and bringing back fresh seafood. It was an experience that, you know, was just deeply valuable. People just loved it. But of course, the more and more people that went out hunting for abalone and other seafood, the fewer abalone they were. I mean, in effect, you know, I described how abalone became super abundant in the wake of sea otters getting hunted out. There was like this giant mass of animals offshore reproducing and, you know, being, and so there were so many of them. But as that big supply got whittled down by so many more fishermen, sports fishermen, commercial fishermen, the number shrank and shrank and shrank. And as that number went down, the animals became more vulnerable to new types of stresses, such as El Ninos and such. But anyway, I found it fascinating to talk to some of the people who were engaged in sport diving. And the stories of the bottom scratchers was particularly interesting because they formed a dive club. And they required their members to go out and perform feats of going down and diving for three abalone on one breath hold. So holding your breath and going down, getting three abalone at once, and spearing a fish, and they had different sorts of initiation rites that were as much a testament to their to the abundance of marine life in the waters as it was to their prowess in diving. It's kind of, it was an interesting story to find.
Well, another story you tell, and this woman was a scuba diver. You say that Mia Tegner is credited with saving the abalone from extinction. Who is Mia Tegner?
Well, Mia Tegner was a wonderful woman, very brilliant marine scientist in Southern California. And she started out studying sea urchins, and she became a diver and started to study kelp forests under, you know, off the coast. And she kind of got tapped to start doing some research on abalone, especially if there was any way to restore them. So that was in the 70s and 80s. She was out, you know, studying the reefs, trying to understand how marine ecosystems worked. And one of the things that was interesting for me to learn in my book is that marine research is really difficult. I mean, especially early on, before we had the scuba gear to be able to go out and stay underwater and observe. But even afterwards, you know, things change so much. People can have to go out and study, come back in. And the knowledge that's amassed is really almost like building a little brick at a time in a structure to understand what's going on. So she was engaged in some of that kind of work, really understanding how it worked. Well, so I described that there were all sorts of, you know, there was too much fishing happening. And then there was a series of El Ninos that came and knocked out abalone's main source of food in Southern California, kelp, for a while. And it just made it harder for those animals to survive. And Mia was tracking some of this and putting together how this was. In the late 1990s, when there was a big push to try to close the commercial abalone fishery, basically sports divers realized, gosh, if we don't close the fishery, we're going to fish these animals to extinction. We're not going to have them to, we're not going to have the broodstock to rebuild and recover the population. And Mia Tegner got involved in that. She was, she testified as the expert and was able to, because she had spent so much time underwater, because she had really studied how the marine ecosystems work, she was able to make a compelling case to the Fish and Game Commission and to the California legislature that we really needed to close the commercial fishery at that time and try to restore abalone for the future. So she played a really pivotal role as a scientist.
And she paid a heavy price for her study.
Yes. And one of the sad things is, you know, when you're writing about history, kind of go back and you're studying what happened and the stories of these people and their accomplishments and what they do. And one of the really sad things is that Dr. Tegner died in a diving accident. She was off doing research off the coast, and she, you know, diving accidents happen. She unfortunately was subject to that. And so she died in her 50s, way too young for such a talented person. She, at the time, had just recently had completed a study on the white abalone, which is another species that actually is the most endangered species in California. It was the evaluation that, and a population assessment for that animal that made it possible for it to be designated an endangered species in 2001. So that was one of the last things she did, and that did lead to the listing of the white abalone as an endangered species, which was the first marine invertebrate to be ever listed as an endangered species. You know, that's a dubious distinction and a sad story all around. But the positive of that is that that designation has really helped scientists to put attention to recovery and restoring that particular species, Southern California species of abalone. And I hope that all the knowledge that's been gained through that effort can be put to use in helping us restore all the species of California's abalone.
My guest is environmental historian Ann Velises, who has written a book about abalone. And just before we conclude, there was one other woman who helped promote kids' knowledge about abalone. Her name was Mary Caruso, and you said she was trying to teach school kids about a kelp forest, but none of them knew about abalone. So what did she tell them? Who did she tell them to ask about abalone?
Oh, it was great. This is Captain Nancy Caruso. Yeah, she is an ardent environmental educator in Southern California, and she told her school kids to go and ask their parents and grandparents about abalone. And these kids came back with all sorts of stories about how abalone had been plentiful and how abalone was eaten traditionally. And it was really fascinating because they became very enthusiastic and about restoring abalone themselves. Nancy brought aquaculture tanks into classrooms and helped these kids to raise green abalone. That's another species of Southern California abalone. And they were watching the abalone grow and measuring them and feeding them. And they really came to know and appreciate these animals. And but it really is poignant that this animal that was so prevalent for a while on California's coast is so little known by up-and-coming generations now. And so that was, you know, a poignant thing to realize that animals that could be so important to our culture, connection to place in the ocean, could kind of, you know, be lost so easily. And so I think her work to educate the next generation about the values of the kelp forests and all their animals is important. And she's still working to figure out how to help restore green abalone in Southern California.
Well, you did get a chance to taste abalone, didn't you, Anne, at one point?
I did. I was interested in abalone, and I thought, well, I've got experience going out and diving and eating abalone. When I did it, it was in the early, I think it was about 2012 or so. I met a friend who is actually a diver who I met, a park ranger from the Channel Islands, who came every year to Mendocino to go out and dive for abalone. Actually, thousands of people had the tradition of coming to the north coast of California, where red abalone remained abundant owing to a really tightly regulated fishery.
Thank you so much, Anne, for telling us about abalone today.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
Remind you, the title of Anne Velisa's book is Abalone, The Remarkable History and Uncertain Future of California's Iconic Shellfish.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.